So welcome everybody, and I need to thank the Arts Council of England who support the whole festival, which is absolutely wonderful. And most importantly, I need to thank Melissa Lee Houghton for coming and joining me for this conversation this morning. So first of all, I'll just introduce myself very briefly. My name's Chloe Garner and I'm the Artistic Director of Ledbury Poetry Festival. So I need to, I think, make it really clear from the start that I'm not of any expert in mental health at all. And now to introduce you to Melissa Lee Houghton. Melissa Lee Houghton is a next generation poet. That's a title given by the Poetry Book Society to kind of pull out interesting talent that's going to be significant potential, which is a lovely honour, and has two previous collections with Penned in the Margins, who have also published Melissa's third collection, Sunshine. And those collections were A Body Made of You and Beautiful Girls, which was a Poetry Book Society recommendation. Sunshine, this book I have here, which is also on sale at the back, was a Guardian Best Poetry Book of 2016. And I Am Very Precious, one of the poems inside the book, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best Single Poem. Yes, I think we can say that we're about to begin. So thank you, Melissa, for coming.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here. It's the first year I've ever been to Ledbury, so this is a treat for me. Do you want me to open up with the reading?
Yes, I think that would be lovely.
Okay, let me have. I've got really bad hay fever, so if I sound a bit not on top form, I thought I'd read you. I tend to write quite long poems, so I'll read you one long poem and sort of open it up. May occasionally have to sip some water. Hella. Joseph. I found docility in this room whilst you were sleeping deeply elsewhere. The sun accentuated your riper version of me. To channel your history, he left me. So I showered and took sedatives for the knockout pain. You erased my image from the mirror kindly, paternally inviting a better one, a real Hella, to materialise more truthfully in the morning. The key card had to be removed at the door to turn off the light, so I tripped ungracefully, stumbled over the polished oak floor, insensitive to my fallible sensibilities, and plunged for the bed. The pristine wilderness of it, unhomed, and oh, what can I tell you? I envisioned you perched at the writing desk, writing only to me. I replayed our recent collusions, ones in which I recited lines from my own poems. Oh God, the whiskey was just so deplorably good, and the spices must have inflamed my grandiose nature. Your private smile had my own key of chromatic energy locked in it. The scales of you struggled to their climactic point just before bed. I look at you and I see India turning, turning, turning. All night, I took more sedatives episodically, forgetting how many I took, couldn't bash my lights out for the thought of you. Oh, the guilt I passed on via 100-rupee notes into the dry palms of beautiful male waiters. Creasing in the night from my elevated mood, transfixed on my shallow breathing, my imagined fatal arousal relineated the room as my extended self, extended over an entire continent, encapsulating the escapist in you. There is just nowhere you can be now. I'll devour. Oh, my coercive tendencies hold no sway here. The light dominates the feeling, but look into its dereliction. Oh, under these bed sheets, yes, climb in, do, I'll pay all the debts. The sun has my back, The new day writes it all off with my knack for making promises and keeping secrets. I have a 20-year embargo. Then my books crackle with the cynicism of having lost everything again. And come soon. Having my fill of Camus, I fully absorb and inhabit my solitude. It's a beautiful art. The country and I are your playthings, and you are God of right here and right now and all the gaps between day and night. Oh, Daddy, cross my palms, I'll not decay. The internet attracts the vindication of us. You like an irregular heartbeat, like yours, and must. You're in the downstairs bar performing experimental cunnilingus on a cocktail glass. The heart mourns its yearning, a speculation over ice, over me. We perform what we cannot confront. Who can alleviate the guilt now? Only me and trouble. In the early morning, I hear the destitute erect the stage outside for a rich man's wedding. Pee-eyed, I open the curtains on a 12-foot window. Oh, my, I must take a photograph and send it to you. If you could see me now. The whole universe from here is a scarred womb with all its violence. The vegetation beyond my room conceals what shimmers inside the oyster shell of imaginative obsession. Prize this whole construct open and I'll be forever yours. Use your hands. The narcissist's bed is dishevelled at once on hearing the ping of a text which opens the possibility of the eternal, which is shut down in a singular moment, and time, therefore, has a chink in its meaningless chain. How big do you need me to be? I can make a room look empty. I can fill you with my fantasy, project yours back to you where we nearly slipped on the red carpet. The fairy tale omits the possibility of failure as you, my prince, become more hooked on the details of my desires. Under a gazebo, we make polite conversation with the other and gorge ourselves on gaze, the newly formulated lies. How very progressive we are when we unrealised rules our parents created so we couldn't suffocate ourselves. I walk around with lungfuls of pure dust, zero hangovers in 7 drunk days, reeling from the embarrassment of failing in front of you. What could be worse for a person than seeing the faults in an uncompromising, compromised longing? Every time a plane takes flight, I think of going down with the fuselage with you. Every time we land, I am so saddened by our surviving. You wrote back, it's not me. A lump in my throat of the early morning meeting over a grey boiled egg and sweet masala tea in a godforlorn shantytown, practising starvation, because if I have what I want, the lack falls back to where it cannot be grieved, killed outright, filled up, or viewed from an essential distance. It provides for me no less than 100% my daily allowance. If you want to be my whole, then swallow. In the belly of a drowning whale somewhere, our conceptual united heart is rotting. And anyway, my father, if still alive, would still be older and more fucked up than you, even more incapable of loving me. I was born to love, a megalomaniac or an addict, and all I got was this T-shirt, I said. My aphoristic sense of humour develops chronic pneumonia whenever you turn your back, but I want to see everything. We are formulating our legacy through language. What price will I pay for it? And can I stop myself before I write myself into a phantasmagorical cave? Where are your blue eyes now, and what do they stare through? See without me. The hot coffee, the inadequate tips, the nauseating chrysanthemums, the string quartets, the famous novelists, the desire for infinite sex and drugs around the clock, the loot jumping CD track, and right now, my veins and your veins, and the cosmos situated visibly in between them, between our egos and our lack of moral responsibility. We foot the demand just to spite the city, and I lied when I said I don't assume a role for you. I assume any role I want to fit. Be my incestuous past. Eat from my breast. Foam at the mouth. I wrote all my best work under the delusion of gratification, delayed several light years by the impossibility of romance. If only I'd been more imperfect. The city's hands throb tonight. There are no bombs beneath the car bonnet. You check, but don't really scan. My white-gloved driver thinks I am rich and stingy when in fact I am merely a fantasist. You wish for me my dream. You must first remove all desire from it. I couldn't fall back once I tasted it. Go home. My intelligence is a rainbow. It's a phenomenon, not a science. Oh, I'm chewing hard on the nipple. The good breast heaves only for me. There is none for you, so I'll offer none. I will drain her until I'm sick, just so you can't have it. The rain hasn't touched our skin for a definite spell. I shake hands with so many people to emphasise my need for direct sensation. Regurgitate my sweetness. I want back our lapsing consciousness. Here, check your phone again. You missed me. She bites through the cord, jams a key card in, saunters back down to reception, wearing dark glasses, crying. 3 hours sleeps, jet lag of devilishness, and 1,000 rupee soda. I shrink down to black mink heels with an appetite to die for. Nothing surreal about unimaginable pleasure except that it won't last. My sapling idea buried in the grave of primacy. See how the erotomaniac, once spurned, never dies. You text, what beautiful photos. My inevitable disappointment with words urinates, blows its bloody nose, the pressure erupts, writes the words. If I am an artifact for you, this world is the universe's sad mausoleum. I double underline the word sad as room service arrives with a man with steady hands, and he asks me why I'm crying, and I take a picture of the bourgeois tea caddy. My work is bereft of all ownership now. I refuse to take responsibility for what would flow through me regardless of my active voice. You won't recognise my pain or my body. It doesn't tell you any more than that red smear when I wiped myself this morning can tell me a single hard fact about God.
What a brilliant way to start. That's such a full, rich poem. And I think it's brilliant because when I was thinking about this event and the mental health and poetry, I was thinking about how poets need to be able to make free associations, need to be able to make all kinds of sound associations, need to have an ability to be completely obsessive, need to really want to push words as far as they can go. There's so many things that you need to be doing as a poet, all of which that poem is doing, and at the same time, all those things are can tend or have tended or are often portrayed as what leads poets into madness or makes the strong connections that people have in their heads between mental health and this, you know, the ideas along. So what I wanted to say was, for you, when you're writing, what's the process that you do, you know, you're using to write your poems, or are you writing at the time of the experiences? Or
I think my process is possibly a little bit unusual, and I only know that from talking to so many people who write, but I do write every day, and with Simon Armitage, there was a question yesterday about, you know, do you write every day, something like that, and he said, well, you can't write, you can't live at that pitch, but I live at that pitch, like I definitely do. So from about 11 o'clock every night till 4 o'clock every morning, I will write, and a lot of it will be poetry. So the process is basically, I inhabit my own existence very fully. I feel like I absorb everything that I see and hear all day long. I have a very strange gift of photographic recall and kind of oral recall. I can kind of record and remember whole conversations and how somebody looked constantly. So basically at night when I don't sleep, if I don't empty my head, I would become completely insane. So that's what I do. And the process is basically, I'll have a line in my head and I just start writing it. That's it, really. Obviously, there's a lot of editorial work later on, but generally I'll spend a year just writing and writing and writing, not edit anything whatsoever, and eventually formulate some kind of collection out of it. And I've written two this year that are probably double the size of a normal of that. So four times that I've written already. It is a mode of existing for me. It's not merely an art form. So yeah, the process is interesting, but I think it's all art forms are practice based. So you are kind of obliged to do a lot of it. And I know that a lot of people don't. They don't think that's true, but I just think if you're going to throw yourself into anything in life, you might as well completely do it. And this is what I've decided to do with my life. Yeah.
And that comes out of your poems because there is a lot of conversation and talking. Yeah. Back to different characters that are there in your life. And so would you say it's true that your poems are mostly the I in your poems is you, or do you...
That's interesting. I have a feeling that for other people sometimes I'm the object of the poems. So the I to the reader might be an object, which is an idea, which is me. So me as an idea. The I when I'm writing is definitely me. So I'm the subject. My I is, I'm the subject of the work. It's just I think there's a very interesting relationship in work where you're writing about yourself as the subject between the writer and the audience. I actually think there's quite a lot of psychoanalytic transference that happens. And partly the reason that I use I and you is because I'm also involving the reader. So I'm not just saying whoever the addressee is to me when I'm writing it. I'm also saying it's everybody else who's reading it or listening to me. And sometimes people have said when I do a reading, they feel like I am speaking to them. You know, I'm saying a very direct sentiment, and I'm talking to the whole of the audience and saying, and you. So there's a whole very complex thing going on there. It's not merely me saying, this is me, and I'm telling you this thing that happened to me, and I feel like this about it. So it's a lot more complex than that.
It's really interesting, yeah.
So the poem, just for you were talking about the editorial process. How big was that when it started?
This is going to sound very strange, but this is the truth. I don't remember a single of anything I've ever written. I have no idea where I was when I wrote it, when it was that it was written. I have no idea I keep everything, but I never look back through any drafts, notebooks. I've got hundreds of notebooks. I don't look at them. So partly, I mean, you know, like this is interesting because a lot of times if you look at collected works, often, like for example, with Sylvia Plath, they're dated. The poems are dated. I make an effort to never record dates of anything. I don't want to remember anything. My sense of time is bizarre. I don't remember things sequentially, so I have no idea when I wrote that, other than I know kind of what it was about and how I was feeling. So I have no idea even. I honestly couldn't tell you. And then the editor of the collections obviously had a go at it as well. So it's been through lots of process. Yeah. I mean, people often say to me, do you ever edit? You know, well, of course I do. But yeah, I've no idea, literally got no idea when I wrote that, where I was, why I wrote it, or anything. I don't want to know. It exists, and that's kind of enough.
Well, that's it. I mean, I've got two things I want in my head now, but there's one thing which is to do with how to generate the kind of language and energy that you need to talk about the subject that you're talking about. I was really interested in that, where, you know, because we're talking about things that are, you know, there's real pain, there's a lot of anguish in the poems, anger, there's very extreme emotions, and so how are you, have you any sort of sense of how you push for the words, or push for what you, the energy in the poems, and I think it might be to do with the way you write, but I want to know what you think of it.
Well, I see it as though, if you're going to go and run a marathon, you don't just set off one day and run a marathon. You have to train and train and train. You have to build up your muscles, and particular parts of your body need to get stronger and work in different ways. You have to think about all kinds of things. You have to create a situation where you can successfully run a marathon without killing yourself. And it's exactly the same with poetry, to me, because I've trained my brain in a certain way for many, many years. I've written all my life. And because it's so practiced, because I don't just write poetry, I write prose and essays and plays, and your brain starts to develop. You have to train your own intellect. And my engagement with language is a 24/7 obsession. Mm. But also, I live a life where I assimilate all my experiences, and nothing is lost on me at all, nothing's wasted on me. I think that's a very important part of being a writer. I don't think you can kind of just go, right, I'm going to go and get the bus to work now, I'm really tired. You can't live like that. You have to go, I hate buses, but my God, isn't it amusing that that person's on that bus there? Like, you have to be willing to also, like, be unapologetic about your own anger and go, I'm angry. You just basically can't live a watered down life if you want to be very serious about writing. You become an obnoxious human being, if I'm quite honest with you, very quickly. But I don't care. I mean, I'm so committed to it that this is the only thing that I'm happy to maintain about life. It's the only thing that I sort of pursue, is keeping writing stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So, were you writing poetry then before? How does it relate with your mental health? You diagnosed as bipolar. Do I understand that right?
Yeah.
Were you writing before then, or can you talk a bit about the relationships?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm a very bad spokesperson for so-called mental health, because for a start, mental health is a term that implies that there is some kind of sanitary vision of the mind, and where some people's minds are kind of pristine white globes that radiate light and things like that, and other people's are kind of like festering with maggots and things, which is probably mine. But the thing is, it doesn't mean anything. What mental health means is it's a term that helps the government more than any people in the world, because what it says is that we should have minds that are so functional that we can all contribute to society, everything will start working really smoothly, and we all will go to work and everything will be fine forever after. And if we can't do that, we'll take loads of drugs, everything will be rosy. It's an absolute pile of bullshit, because the whole situation is so much more complex than that. So my writing became, I wanted to be a painter or an artist or something like that. I used to paint quite a lot. What happened though was that I had no money at all, so I couldn't afford pen. So I realised that I had to do something that didn't cost anything. So just the basics started writing, it cost nothing, does it? And I even wrote on my body at the time. I remember, I was 21, I'd write on my clothes and on my skin. Just anything. I had this little dictaphone somebody gave me, so I'd sort of record stuff. I became completely obsessed with language, but I always read very widely. But I had started to go a bit mad. I've got to say that I think it was probably largely because my life was unbearably shit and stressful, but also I took a lot of drugs and that didn't help. But the way I sort of processed everything became this very much this pressured engagement with language And then that was it. I mean, the day I started to really seriously go out, I'm going to write, I'd written a book in 6 months. I mean, the amount of manuscripts I've written, and obviously not all published by any means, there's just so many of them, it just never stops. But that's kind of a pathological commitment to the art form. I mean, it doesn't even matter that they'll never be read. It doesn't actually matter to me. It's a means of it existing. So but the thing is, I do believe that there's not a person in the entire universe who doesn't have valid reason to be in distress. There's not a single human being that should, you know, people say, oh, I feel really bad, I've not really got any reason to. I always say, you've got every fucking reason to. You're living in this world. Like, what reason haven't you got? You know, you'd have to really look hard to find that you had no reason to me. But the thing about anguish and distress and pain, the thing about the word depression, for example, is that it's so overused. We use that. It's a kind of a, it has a function. It's a functional word. However, if you think about the language that you have for distress, you have despair, distress, anguish, sadness, melancholy. There's a whole wealth of language for suffering. That's for a good reason. And so if we try to find... I remember a young woman said to me recently, she said, oh, Melissa, I've got all these problems, I'm feeling all these things, I just want to know what it is. I want the word, you know, do you think I have depression? Do you think I have... I said, sweetheart, there is a lot of words for this. There's not one word. You're not going to find somebody that gives you this one magic word that explains what's going on with you. You need to find all of the words. It's going to take you a very long time. But when you've done it, those words will be there and they'll be yours. And they might be like a volume of literature that's like that big, and that's fine. But I guess there's just so many words. We need to be employing them more to talk about these things, I think.
That's a really, really great answer. I'd like to open up now to see if anybody would like to come in at that moment.
Thank you for your reading. I have mental health and physical health problems, and I liken a hospital to a human body. And so one section will be the brain, one section will be the lungs, the heart, but they're all siloed, and there's no interrelationship between the two. So you'll have an endocrinologist, and then you'll have a heart specialist,
yeah.
And you go around these. And that seems to me to reflect what you were saying about, it's almost like the neck up and the neck down.
Mm.
And there the two shall meet. But in fact, the interaction is such that it's almost like a chicken and egg. I don't know whether my mental health problems are caused by my physical problems or my physical problems,
yeah.
Etc. And I think that's part of the problem of segregating body parts in terms of the way in which they are dealt with medically.
Yeah.
So it's not really a question. Well, I do have a question, which is probably an unfair one, in the sense that if you were to choose one writing form that you have to stay with...
Poetry. That's how I exist.
But that's interesting in the sense of what you were saying about what Simon Armitage said, living in a village.
Yeah.
Because I understood that. Because I, when writing at that pitch, it's very, very intense. And I can understand... And you do the others, you end up almost like writing prose as a release, whereas the intensity of writing poetry is living at another level of pitch.
I'm happy to live at a level of intensity. I'm a single woman, I've got to say. I mean, you wouldn't want to spend too much time with me, you know, it's a nightmare. But I'm happy to do it, that's what I want to do with my life.
I was just thinking, if you live like you described there, I suspect that level of intensity anyway, because of the way your brain works.
Yeah.
Then you're
going to
live like that.
Well, that's it. It does. It makes me be able to bear my own existence. I do think that,
yeah. I'm fascinated to hear you read because you're amazingly articulate. It's almost as if you tapped into dreaming. And I wonder, when do you sleep? Do you nap?
This is actually this is really interesting. I've always had really bad sleep problems. When I was a child, I had this, I'd go into a hypnagogic state and wander about and have really strange conversations with people I didn't remember. I mean, sleep is a really, it's a really huge problem. So I have chronic insomnia, And for the last at least 10 years, probably a lot longer than that, I've never been able to get to sleep without some kind of soporific substance. So I have to drug myself to go to sleep, because I'm always fully on all the time.
Yeah.
But so because I take sleeping tablets, I generally don't dream at all because they just knock me out. So it's like it's just a functional thing. I wish I didn't have to go to sleep. I get, at night I just go, for God's sake, why can I not be doing something else? You know, it's a nightmare, I hate it. If I have to, sometimes you have a little cat nap in the afternoon. Because weirdly, I could talk about this all day, but weirdly I can sleep at any point during the day just like that. but the reason the book's called Sunshine is actually because I have such a profound obsession with the day and night. When I was a child, I used to think that I was in a completely different world when it went dark. I mean, I actually just felt, I even felt like if it was in a dark room, all the objects were different. Everything had changed so dramatically. It's never left me that. And it, well, so,
I think it's extremely weird in our culture that we need our children in the dark.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've already gone to sleep, that's fine. Isn't it?
Yeah, well, I used to get locked in my bedroom as a child at night, you know, and I wasn't allowed out until my bedroom was unlocked again. And it was a different world, and it was pitch black, and it was just horrific. So I've never got over it. So the sunshine, the sun coming up, the sun going out, if I can watch the sunrise and the sunset as many times as I possibly can, I will do it. I completely am obsessed with the sunrise and the sunset. And I often think that if your life is really awful and you're really suffering unbearably, you at least know that the sun will rise at some point. The sun will set, and it will give you, if you've only got those two things tethering you to existence, they're at least a structure. So a whole range of obsessions there. I sometimes do have amazing dreams, though. I've got to tell you, when I have them, it's brilliant because I wake up hysterically laughing. And they're often about Luke Kennard, honestly. And I will wake up and text them to him. And then he'll be, honestly, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
Without fail. I'd love to tell you them, but obviously I'm not going to do it. But yeah, it's really good.
Just one of them, I was wondering, do you use pen? You mentioned notebooks, so do you write in the background?
Oh yeah,
you
I've
do.
Got.
So you have to sit there.
Yeah, well, I do. This is another thing. Formally, I mean, one of the problems that my new poems that I've had to turn the page landscape with when I type them, but also that. God, this is really interesting questions. But honestly, my God, this is like the whole. I'm writing a thesis at the moment. The whole thing is just sort of imploded in my head. But yeah, so. I will write a lot of things longhand, but you can't fit so much on a page. I wish I could publish a book that was just like that, like massive, and just fill the whole thing up, because I've started to just be so expansive.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've always written. I've got hundreds of notebooks. I'll probably never look at them again, but they are full of illegible scribbles and. You have to. It's a physical art. Even if you're looking at that, you just think that's some stuff printed on a page. Your body has to engage with it to make it happen. Typing's kind of not really good enough. Some people can only type for various reasons, and that kind of works. But you find your own way of making it into a physical act. You know, because you need that energy. And it's like most of the time, I will walk and walk and walk for hours, and I will. Work myself up into a state of like energetic, and also when I'm out walking, I refuse to ever write anything down or record anything, because I just want I want to have really great lines in my head and lose all of them, and because it makes me so frustrated, and then I get back and I need to write something, and I will just sit for 3 hours and write something, but you need that energy, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the page you write on will change what you write. If you allow yourself to write on a really tiny thing or a really big space.
It's an interesting thing, because I think people forget that that's the space that you've got to write something on will determine a lot of what happens when you write a piece of work. I couldn't cope with writing on anything that size, for example. It would drive me insane. Like, I sometimes go out and buy really big artist sketchbooks and fill them up. And then you can restructure the whole thing when you put it into... when you type it out and things. But you've got to be working at that level as a writer, I think. You've got to be thinking about space and how to utilise everything you've got available to you. Yeah.
Thank you.
And for me, there's like an emotional aftermath when I write poems. Like, sometimes I will literally just start crying. And also, because I have had depression before, and sometimes it can send me to a slippery slope of depression.
Yeah.
So I just really, or any other emotion for you, like if it's anger or a memory of someone, because also I get replays about an incident.
Yeah.
It's quite a trigger, but I get my best work. So do you ever have an emotional aftermath, like the anger of it, or it lingers, or you're ruminating, or because I just don't know how to cope with that side of it?
Well, it's interesting. Somebody asked me something like this recently, and I... The one time I seem to completely lack affect whatsoever, I have any feelings, is when I'm writing. So even if you read that, like that poem, for example, you think, oh, she must have been in a state of, like, you know, in a meltdown. I wasn't. I was completely serene. I am actually a very serene person, strangely enough. Asked Denise Rowley, she told everybody yesterday I was very serene. It was lovely.
Yeah.
I am. I think that I've separated. This is not entirely me. This is why it's so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It is completely 100%, but at the same time, I have separated two modes of myself. So there is the person that's creating the work,
mm-hmm.
there is the person that's had the experience.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different. I can't. If they were both together, the work would be a blancmange of crap. It wouldn't actually mean anything. So I have to... Sometimes I will shake, you know, if I've had it, but it's more to do with the adrenaline and the excitement, because there's kind of an addictive quality to work in that I like, and I start to, like, fizz with...
Yeah.
And then I'll have to go and get really drunk.
I think I'm still at that page where it's all one.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not writing about myself, my experience is still, it's so me. I can't quite separate it. I think that's what you need to do.
Do you find one thing that possibly might help, and I'm not sure, but one thing that's helped me to create that separation is to do a lot of things that are physical exercise and exert yourself physically before you do the writing. Imagine if you're limbering up, right? You're going to do like a big wrestling match. You've got to see it like that. This wrestling match is going to be exquisite. You're going to win. You've got an amazing costume, right? It's all set up. So that's the poem that you're going to write, the wrestling match. But you don't just turn up and start wrestling, do you? You've got to warm up.
Okay.
You've got to prep for this thing. So you've got to get yourself in the mood, you know. You've got to drink a bit of coffee, get a bit hepped up on coffee, smoke a couple of fags, and go for a really long walk, go for a run, do something very energetic, have sex. I don't mind what it is you do, it doesn't really matter. But as long as you use a lot of energy, because that will get you sort of physically primed for the wrestling.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing the wrestling, you'll be so exhausted at the end of it, basically, you'll just be like, oh my God, I need a cigarette. You just smoke, and then you'll be fine. You'll feel better.
And there's another interesting question around playing with the voice you speak with, so the I in poems, but the you or the he, or and if you, what happens when you change the voice that you're working with in your poem, turn it into you? Do you think there's anything in just in terms of how it?
I think you can only be led by the impulse. So whatever that impulse is to write is what you're going to write. And if you don't follow it, you're not really going to be doing the writing you need to do. There's no easy way around it at all. I mean, in hours where you're not writing and you're not getting yourself prepped, try very hard to nurture yourself by enjoying things as much as possible, so that when you're in that intense place, you're not in it all the time. So I take enormous pleasure in all things, and if I don't, I complain about them, you know. So if I'm going to do something, I'm going to make sure that I leech every last bit of enjoyment out of it, and that can kind of keep you on a little bit more of a level. And so when you've been in that intense place, go, I really like ice cream, I'm going to rub it over my face, you know? Something like that. I mean, this is just me. I mean, you could tell that it would be, like, useless as a mentor for anything here. But maybe try it, I don't know, put ice cream on your face, I don't know.
Exactly. I'm sure there are other questions, but I was interested, I mean, what I partly enjoyed about the book, from my perspective, was, you know, reading poems about female sexuality that were really, you know, seemed to me very open, and that I found really quite wonderful to read. You know, not always the easy parts of being, obviously, female and not the way that we are as women. So I wondered if you'd talk maybe a bit about that, but also I suppose I was interested in terms of talking about taboos as well, which is something that seems to, you know, be something that people might be interested in. Is there anything that for you might be a taboo, and do you have a sense of yourself as kicking against the idea of taboo or the things we're not supposed to speak about?
No, not really. I don't really have any conscious desires to write about anything specific, kick against anything. I don't really try. I never sit down and construct a theme or an idea and go, I'm going to do this. I just write. Mm. Whatever ends up in it is just whatever ends up in it. Obviously, most of the things are things that everybody's goes through. Things about sexuality, well, you know, people all reach sexual maturity and people have sex. So basically, if it's in there, it's just because it's part of my experience. Not really got. There was a time when I imagined that maybe I had a role in a sense to talk about. Particularly talk about abuse and what it's like to be a victim of abuse, but then go, but I really like sex. Like, that seemed like a thing that I thought was really important that I wanted to try and do. For about a month or something, I had this idea, I could talk about that and it might be really interesting to people. And I realised that that's not the role of the writer. Mm. It's not really a conscious political act. Mm. Even if the writing becomes political, you cannot have the impetus. The impetus cannot possibly be to make a political statement. I don't think that's what art is for. People might disagree, but that's the way I feel about it. So in thinking that thing about, so I've been seriously abused in my life, if I talk about that, and I did realise that it was just a false idea about my role. So I gave up on it all. Talking about sex and desire, what's been interesting to me, actually, is that when I read some of the poems that are very explicit, the reactions I get are bizarre. In fact, sometimes quite frightening. There is no good sex in this book. It's miserable. It's deeply unhappy. And I remember doing a reading where I read I Am Very Precious, which is very explicit. But it's a very frustrated poem, and it's about pain more than it is about desire, really. And I did the reading, and somebody came up and said, I'm going to go home and masturbate over you. You know, and I get things like this a lot, and I just couldn't understand what was going on there. I thought, you've basically enjoyed watching my pain, me performing my own pain. So there's a whole... I actually don't know sometimes. I get to a place where I don't know whether there is any value in people watching me or hearing me articulate this work, whether it's necessary. I do enjoy it. I know other people enjoy it. But there's been so many... there's so much room for misinterpretation and also that weird transference where people have projected such a lot of their own ideas onto you. It's a very dangerous thing to talk about as a woman. I do have to say as well that I've had quite a lot of bad stalking incidents and things, to the point where I couldn't go to readings on my own anymore. So it's a serious thing. Right. So I think I just didn't understand that if I was going to come out in a public arena and talk about these things very openly, and that it was in some way quite powerful or weird. It was just me going, I'm just going to do that. That's what I do. I'm a writer. For other people, some people got quite. You know, I've had some very, very significant online abuse and things like that because of it. So it's a very. I didn't realise just how potent it was going to be for other people. Yeah. And I want to be responsible for that, but you know, I'm not a politician, I'm not changing the world, I'm not changing anybody else's views about anything. So my responsibility really should begin and end with how I behave in society and the work that I put out there being as good as I can make it. Well, that's, that should be it.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Hello, Melissa. It's just breathtaking, well, I'm breathtaking, by your dedication and commitment and absolute immersion in this. And I think it's an enormous blessing. That can be a rather floating word, but I hope you'll take it as a strong word.
Yeah, I do.
I'm thinking of people who don't have that facility.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've had, perhaps some of your friends, or if you've had ideas or experience about the enormous power of reading poetry. Mm. And I remember, I know, I hope that's not deflecting too much from this workshop, because it's mainly about writing poetry, but a lot of people can't or won't or don't, or link somehow. But and there's a great headline by Jeanette Winston once in a paper saying, poetry should be made available on the NHS. So I know you don't want to get into politics and government and that sort of thing, but I remember I once went, you know, I'd given up with the various doctors ever making sense of what I wanted them to make sense of. Finally, a new doctor came, unfortunately from Australia, so I lost him again pretty quickly. He's back there. And so I just filled out quite a few, I can't remember, and the detail doesn't matter. But at the end of my allotted 12 minutes, I was lucky, 12 minutes, he leaned forward to press his computer, and I thought, oh, I thought he was so great. He's like all the rest. I don't want a prescription. So anyway, I just sighed, and I thought, well, I'll be good, and I'll accept this piece of paper. And when I looked down, it was a poem. Now, I was bonded from then on to this doctor, because instead of a prescription, to be given a poem just was so, so great. And when he had to go back to Australia, at our last meeting, he brought two copies of poetry by... Do you know, what's her name? The American poet. Not Mary Oliver. Mary Oliver.
Mm.
And he had two copies, and he said, look, I've brought two copies, one for you and one for me, so we'll be reading. So such solidarity there. And for some years, I was working in a drop-in centre, you know, for people who've been in hospital for years and years and years, and very, very institutionalised. And so they've had lots of clinical groups. But then emerged a poetry group, simply sitting around reading, choosing and reading. It totally transformed that centre.
Definitely. I've written quite widely, written essays on things like this, and I honestly believe, there's a few things that I honestly believe about this, but one is that, that the way to unlock a lot of distress and people who are in distress is definitely to use language. I've taught somebody who was completely illiterate, didn't know the alphabet, he could still write something, because the thing is, it didn't matter what he wrote on the paper, what shapes it were, who could understand it. He was processing something to even be able to put... It was still flowing through him in some kind of beautiful circle of creation. And then he could express it and he could talk about it. So it doesn't actually matter if you're even literate, I don't think. And I think that it would be a wonderful thing if there was money involved, in if the government poured money in to creative writing within psychiatric units, but basically if they poured money in full stop to people that needed psychiatric help, you know. But it would be such an amazing therapy. I've had so much experience of this, and it, without fail, will help any person. They do not need any degree of literacy to even engage with it at all. It's about communication. And the groups are so effective because it's not just somebody sat on their own. Lots of people are communicating very, very complex things that they possibly never have thought about or been able to communicate before. It's a very powerful thing. It would be an absolute game changer if that was available. Every single person that turned up at the doctor's and depressed and they went home with a prescription, it would change the whole landscape. Of mental health, if your experience was just the norm,
The reading. Do you think the reading as well as the writing?
Definitely. Yeah. It's about having conversations. One thing that I find quite frustrating about poetry is that I sometimes feel like I'm having a one-sided conversation. So often I have these constructed addressees that I'm writing to, but they're never going to answer back. But I think as a therapy, as a therapeutic intervention, the power of it is in exchange, is in constructing conversations. And the beauty of poetry is that it comes from a very unconscious place that absolutely any human being can tap into. You need to, there are so many writers in the UK that could very, very, very successfully help people that have no idea how to do that, or even what it means. That would, if they were being paid even small fees, we have a whole country of writers that could be helping people with this. I wrote a book about it, so the psychoanalyst Darian Leader, he loved this book, and I'm in touch with him, we have conversations about it. It's very much the same school of thought about it's all over-medicated, and it's definitely about grabbing hold of the truth of your own story and your own existence. Most people are never given the opportunity to do that in their entire lives, or even know that that's what would help them. It's worrying, really. Yeah. It's so funny.
Short story and then a poetry. But what's really useful about it as well, I think perhaps it deals with some of the issues you were talking about before, is because you've got the text and you read something and then you talk, and then you read some more and then you talk, it manages a little bit of that emotional exposure, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because you've got something to go back to that stops too much of the flow. It means that people don't get traumatised or.
Yeah, but it. Exactly. It's
very
Yeah, that's it. It's even the exposure to somebody else's work. So me reading, doing this group here, I kind of imagine that people have come to this because you're at least aware poetry exists. You've read poetry, you read, you're interested. If this was just a kind of random cross section of people and they had no idea, the poem I read might actually be quite confrontational and difficult for them. You do have to find a way in very gently with things. So yeah, I totally get what you mean. It's terrifying. I have no fear whatsoever about putting myself on the line. I just have none. In fact, I'm a completely fearless person. I'm not even sort of being, grandiose about that. I genuinely have very few fears about things, so I'm okay to do it, you know. But for many people, it would be utterly terrifying to expose themselves in that way. But I do think that it's a great healing thing to be able to do it.
That might be people... that you said have been really bizarre to you afterwards, or online abuse or whatever. I suspect part of that is that it's going to a place that's hard for them to cope with.
Definitely, yeah.
And
yeah, that's it. There's a lot of projection.
It's you that's touched them.
Yeah, you do have to accept that as an artist, and I would describe myself as an artist, that is always going to happen. It doesn't matter who you are. I'm fine with it, really. I mean, there's been a few very dangerous situations. Other than that, if I can keep myself sort of protected and safe, it's just the way it is. I'm okay with it. Yeah.
Is there a question?
Comfortable to talk about these sort of things, or is there something you
develop? No. I mean, when I was a teenager, I stopped speaking completely. I ended up in an asylum in West Yorkshire, because I was very seriously abused when I was little. So it was like I got to a place when I was 13, 14, where there was no point in articulating words whatsoever. I didn't want them in my head. I had no use for them. I just wanted the whole world to shut up. I didn't want to hear anybody else speak. And it's certainly not been like I've not been able to do it. It's really partly because I've practiced the art form and I've become so immersed in it, and so I suppose confident in a way about my understanding of it, and also my understanding of my own work and performing and all these things. It comes together, but it's been a horrendous journey. I used to be so terrified to read. I've been reading for years and years and years. I used to be shaking and I couldn't look at anybody. And this is not something that's been easily that's easily come about for me. This has been a like a fight. This has been like your Mike Tyson fight that I've been really like pummeling something to be able to do this, and I've kind of won. I had no idea I was going to come up with like the cheesiest line ever, but how magnificent. We should be filming this, put it on the internet.
That's lovely. Yeah. We are recording it, which is super.
Good.
Could we? There are no more burning questions, or are there? Is there anybody who really feels they've not had such a chance to speak that they really?
I think I just wanted to thank you, really, because I think I'm like clapping my notes a bit cheesy in a way. It's really genuine.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, I'm listening to you, and I don't think you know, I have read some of this stuff online, but I've never really sort of. When I heard you, I just felt, you know, I did feel a huge identification with the work, because the work was, I don't know you, but the work was. You know, sort of like talking about myself, I'd say that I've sort of like, you know, been very traumatised as well, and sort of been on a bit of an off, you know, I don't even want to use the journey word, but when I hear your work, I kind of like feel like, I don't know, I just feel, it's probably too personal, but I feel like there's no shame in that.
Yeah.
I feel like I can really identify with it, because it's not a shamed voice.
Yeah.
It's not frightening the same. So, I don't know, thank you to that poem. It's really...
Well, thank you. That's really lovely to hear. That's a really... Yeah, I'll take that from today. I'll be like, that was great. Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's... Yes. We are at the end, and so it remains for me to thank Melissa. And I must say, it has been a lovely celebration of writing and reading. And you know, for me, reading your poems, I've had the most amazing dreams. Last night, I had a series of amazing dreams. I woke up really, I was like, oh my gosh, the brain awakes through reading and writing, and it is wonderful, and it's lovely to have been able to explore that and celebrate that through this event, as well as everything else we've talked about. So thank you so much for your wonderful conversation.